Welcome to Dig Deep, the mining podcast. In this podcast, we go deep into mining news, hot topics, and live interviews with mining professionals and leading figures in the mining industry. Introducing your host, Rob Tyson, founder and director of Mining International and Mining International Executive, a leading global mining recruitment and headhunting agency.
Hi, mining community. Welcome back to another episode of the Dig Deep, the Mining Podcast. And today's guest is Peter Leon, who's the partner and African chair of Herbert Smith Freehills, who are one of the world's leading international law firms engaging and tackling the most important challenges and opportunities facing their clients in the mining industry. Peter is regarded as one of the world's prominent lawyers within the resources industry, winning various accolades during his career. He's going to speak to us about new developments in the mineral law, how African countries are looking at implementing law and policies in securing critical minerals, and how the Middle East is emerging as a major player in our space. Peter is also going to be attending and speaking at the upcoming London Indaba at the Intercontinental Park Lane Hotel on the 25th and 26th of June. The event is investing in the resources and mining in Africa, with a focus on Africa's critical role in the minerals and metals of the future. So I'm going to put a link in the comments to this podcast episode, so you can obviously have a look at the event, and hopefully you can purchase a ticket to attend, and hopefully myself and Peter will see you there. So with no further ado, let's welcome Peter to the podcast. How are you doing, Peter?
Very well, thanks, Rob. Good to see you.
And yourself, and appreciate your time on coming onto the podcast and telling us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your career. As I mentioned, you are one of the leading lawyers in our industry. So I wonder if you can just let our audience know, for those that may have not met you before, why don't you just tell us a little bit about your career and a little bit about your background?
Yeah, well, very briefly, I started off life as a securities regulatory lawyer in the early days of my career, and I did a lot of work for the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. I'm South African by origin, now based in London. And about 20-odd years ago, I got a call from one of the major mining companies to help them with some regulatory issues in the mining industry in South Africa. And that led to really a change of career for me as a lawyer. I got involved in all the work on the new mining code in South Africa in the early 2000s, and then started on the back of that doing work elsewhere in Africa, initially in Nigeria and then in East Africa. And subsequent to that, I chaired the mining law committee's quite important work on developing a model mine development agreement for developing countries about 10 years ago, which really resulted from the contract review in the DRC, which the new government initiated. And the World Bank said to us, is there such a thing as a best practice mine development agreement, and effectively asked us to come up with something, which took about 2 years. It was translated into a number of languages and has become something of a bellwether for mine development agreements globally. And then more recently, I was asked by the government in Saudi Arabia to help them with their mineral law reform program, which is all part of the country's Vision 2030, where mining is seen to be, and I think will be, a key part of the Saudi economy, because obviously it's been a country historically very dependent on hydrocarbons. The whole push towards net zero in 2050, obviously the kingdom has to diversify its economy. So mining, along with tourism and other industries, is going to be key to Saudi's future. So that's been a really exciting project to have been involved in. So that's a brief snapshot of my career.
Yeah, certainly. Just wondering if you can just tell us a bit about Herbert Smith Freehills and what kind of services that you do provide to the mining industry.
Well, I think as a law firm, we're one of the major law firms globally in terms of working with the mining industry. We act for some of the world's major mining companies. And I think the thing that perhaps distinguishes us from some of our competitors is the fact that we are a global partnership. It's one partnership. It's not a, you know, it's not a partnership which is divided by region or by country. And the second thing is, because we have such a substantial practice in Australia, which is a key mining jurisdiction, we act for some of the major mining companies in Australia and globally. And then the firm has always done work in Africa, which is really quite key to the mining industry. And about 8 years ago, more than 8 years ago, I was hired by Herbert Smith to help them set up the office in Johannesburg. And one of the things we do in terms of Africa is cover both Francophone and Anglophone Africa, Anglophone from London and Johannesburg, and Francophone from Paris. And we have a very deep bench of mining lawyers who are involved in work in Francophone Africa and have done so for very many years. And the other thing is, a while ago, we set up an office in New York. And out of New York, we also cover Latin America. We have a number of Latin American lawyers in New York and lawyers who are able to work in Latin America. So that's obviously also a very important mining jurisdiction. If you look at things like copper, for example, where for the time being anyway, Latin America is the major copper producer in the world. But, you know, some of that emphasis is now shifting to Africa, which I'm sure we'll talk about in the podcast.
Yeah. You're recognized as one of the world's leading lawyers, obviously, in our industry. And you've won many awards. What would you put this down to? And what would you say your main skills and experience you have to obviously put you in that realm as a leading lawyer?
Well, maybe good luck in some respects or good fortune. No, but seriously, I think it's, I suppose, being on the ground in South Africa when South Africa was going through a really monumental change to its mining code, where effectively mineral rights were put under state custodianship, which caused a huge kerfuffle in the industry, because the whole basis of mining in South Africa prior to 2002, well, the law came into force in 2004, but it was passed in 2002, so more than 20 years ago, was that the industry had always really, the mining rights, mineral rights had always been privately owned, and all of a sudden they were put under state custodianship, and the industry was compelled to move to that system. So being involved in all the work around that, also in some litigation around that in a case which went to the World Bank's dispute settlement facility, ICSID, which I was co-counsel for an Italian granite producers, all of that I think put me in a very good place to do the work I've done elsewhere in Africa and now in the Middle East. And one of the things I've learned from working for mining companies in developing countries is the importance, and we really put this into effect in the Model Mine Development Agreement for the International Bar Association and the World Bank, was the importance of having balanced agreements or balanced legal systems where you effectively have a fair balance of interests between the investor and the host state. And at the same time, one's also having regard to mine or near mine communities. So even though that work was done more than 10 years ago, the lessons of that have certainly resonated with me subsequently. In working in Saudi Arabia, that was a key mission of the government, that we would ensure that communities or near mine communities benefited from resource extraction, given that in the kingdom, mining activities often taking place in very rural areas where there are Bedouin communities, and in a sense, they need to benefit from resource extraction. That's really important. And obviously I've been involved in a number of issues in Africa where things have gone wrong, where mining companies have lost their social license. And my experience from that has been that's because the original investment or the legal regime in terms of that investment was often unfairly tilted towards the investor, potentially at the expense of the state, that's not sustainable in this day and age. And that's where things get out of kilter, and the countries resort to resource nationalism. And you know, how do you mitigate that? So that's one lesson I've learned. You need to have, there has to be fairness in terms of the investment and the concession. Fairness, the host state, a fair fiscal regime, all those things. If you don't have that in place, then my experience is things can rapidly get out of control, and you can have, and we've seen this in a number of countries in Africa, you have a populist president or government elected, and the industry, the mining industry and the investments then become a whip, sort of political whipping boy. So that's something that stayed with me. And I think today, Rob, mining companies are very well aware of that. And sort of the situation you had in Ghana, where I was involved some years ago, where some of the gold mining companies said to the government when they wanted to review their concession agreements, one of the companies said, well, we've got a 30-year stabilization of our whole fiscal and regulatory regimes. The government basically can do nothing about changing that. You simply can't do that. And in fact, the IMF and the World Bank in that situation, that's about 10 years ago, sided with the government. And at the end of the day, the mining companies had to move and couldn't simply rely on the fact that, you know, 30 years ago or 20 years ago, the whole regime had been stabilized, both fiscally and from a regulatory perspective. So the government actually couldn't change the law at all for the life of the mine. I don't think that's fair. I think you can stabilize the fiscal regime to a degree, but to say to a sovereign government that you can't change the law for 30 years, I simply don't think is tenable in this day and age.
Mineral law frameworks have obviously completely changed since the 1990s, and will likely continue, obviously, and evolve rapidly leading up to 2050. What are some of the key changes that you've observed, and what areas of change should we anticipate over the next decade?
Look, there's been huge change. I mean, I suppose one area, leaving aside the sort of ESG mantra, which is obviously very important, but you know, there's huge pressure on environmental regulation, having sort of best practice environmental laws in place, major emphasis on human rights, on supply chains, and all the legislation now coming to the European Union on supply chain due diligence, rehabilitation and closure, that's become a big issue. As I've mentioned in the context of the work I've done in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in Africa, protection of communities and ensuring that communities benefit from resource extraction. The other thing that you're now seeing happening, it started, funny enough, in Ghana 30 years ago, then spread to Brazil, and now feature a number of African mining jurisdictions, is the establishment of independent regulators. So governments started realizing that the traditional approach where the mines ministry was the regulator may not work in the future, simply because A, the people working in the ministry are paid civil service wages and may not be paid appropriately. Secondly, that they may not have the technical expertise. And thirdly, and that's been an issue in Africa, issues of corruption. So in Ghana 30 years ago, the government took the decision to create an independent minerals commission, which effectively processes the whole license regime. The minister grants the licenses, but they're all reviewed by the Minerals Commission. And that model was adopted and I went to a couple of discussions about that in Brazil. That model was adopted in Brazil under President Rousseff's government about 5 or 6 years ago, slightly longer. So in Brazil now has a national mining agency, which is appointed by the president. It's a five-person commission, as I recall, appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. So it's an independent agency. So they've gone even further. And that's basically taken over all the licensing functions from the Mines Ministry. And a number of African mining jurisdictions are now following suit with similar entities. So that's another development. Community grievance mechanisms is something we've seen develop. The other manifestation of this, which South Africa's tried, not entirely successfully, but other African mining jurisdictions are doing, is setting up a one-stop shop. So you have a licensing system, which even if it's covering the Environmental Ministry and the Mines Ministry and the Water Affairs Ministry or whoever else is involved, that you don't have to go from one ministry to another. The licensing process is joined up. The other thing I think there's been a lot of pressure on as a result of all the issues in Brazil with Samarco and Brumadinho with those tailing dams disasters is creating standards around tailings. Of course, the International Council of Mining and Metals, which I've been pleased to do some work, have introduced a standard around tailings. I think that is significant. Now there's a lot of work on biodiversity and nature, which the ICMM is leading. And then obviously the old issues which haven't gone away on mine health and safety. And I think mining companies are much more very, very conscious of the importance of health and safety and avoiding fatalities. So I think there's been obviously black letter law is still very important for mining, but you have all these other issues which are now coming into the equation, and then clearly all the pressure around net zero is creating its own issues for the industry. So I think that one's really seen a real sea change in mineral regulation in the last 20 years. And some countries are much better at doing it than others. But what one's seeing, interestingly, in Africa is, and obviously the World Bank gets involved in some of this work as well, which is commendable, I think, is that when one country develops a new mineral regime, other countries in the region will often follow a particular lead. So that's another thing that one sees.
Conferences such as the London Indaba obviously play an important role in driving the direction of change. What key messages are you hoping to hear from the forthcoming Indaba, obviously where you're going to be speaking?
Well, I think the Indaba, the London Indaba, this is the second Indaba that the organizers have arranged. And then the one last year I thought was very, very successful. Its heading or title is Africa's Future Mining, is Mining's Future Africa. And I think this is, I feel this quite strongly, Rob, that I think this is Africa time has come, because if you look at the whole green energy transition, Africa is pretty key to it. If you look at where, whether it's bauxite in Guinea or manganese in South Africa or cobalt in the DRC, graphite in Mozambique, lithium in Zimbabwe and Namibia, and uranium in Namibia, platinum group metals in South Africa, Africa is the key producer of those minerals and metals. And that's why you have this rush by the EU, by the European Union, to sign agreements with African mineral producers as part of the Critical Raw Materials Act, one of the things that they're doing. You also have the situation where the US has signed quite detailed memorandums of understanding with the DRC and Zambia on battery minerals, metals, around cobalt and copper. And I think you'll see a lot more work coming there. So I really think this is a case of Africa's time has come, because actually, in terms of the green energy transition and the minerals and metals you need for that, this is I think I actually said this in an event last year. This is a reversal, because effectively the balance of power is shifting to Africa and away from the West. So you have to engage African mineral producers in this. What I find really odd about this, and I actually had a call with the Western government yesterday about this, is that if you look at the Mineral Security Partnership, which is obviously led by the US and Canada and the EU and other countries, now including India, there's not a single African mineral producer which is a member of the Mineral Security Partnership, which I find absolutely astonishing. And that's something OECD countries are going to have to do something about, because you can't have a situation where the MSP just leaves out African mineral producers, particularly the most important ones. So I think that will be a theme of the conference, that this is really the Africa's time has come. Obviously, there are going to be some specific discussions, for example, around Simandou, around the work that Rio Tinto is doing there. Obviously, that's a very, that iron ore project is finally getting off the ground. It is the richest iron ore deposit in the world, although there are obviously all sorts of logistical issues and legal issues which have bedeviled it in the past, but that seems to be fortunately now behind us. And I think another theme of the conference will be the green energy transition. How do you decarbonize the steel industry? Things like that. But another theme of the conference is going to be what I was mentioning a moment ago, is how do you partner effectively with African governments? And I think that's going to be a very interesting issue. But of course, when it comes to Africa, one of the issues is how do you de-risk projects? So there's going to be a discussion about that. And one of the issues will come up there is the old chestnut of resource nationalism in Africa, in addition to the operational difficulties you can have in Africa. There's going to be a discussion on geopolitics. I think it's very interesting that Zijin Mining Group, who are very involved in Africa, are going to be speaking at the conference, and there's going to also be a discussion on copper. And then on platinum group metals, on gold, and value addition. So obviously that's a big issue for African mining jurisdictions. And we have quite an interesting development recently in Nigeria, where I've also done some work, where the government's now said, and I hope this doesn't become a pattern, but the government's now said that you will not be able to get a mining license in Nigeria unless you agree to beneficiate the minerals you produce. At the same time, you have a slightly worrying development in some African mining jurisdictions, such as Zimbabwe and Namibia, where the government's basically banned the export of unprocessed lithium, in a sense following the model in Chile. So I think some countries are becoming much more nationalistic in a sense about their resource extraction.
And what will your key message be at the event where you're speaking?
Well, I'm going to talk quite a lot about partnerships, the importance of partnerships, some of the things I talked about now, on maintaining a fair balance of interests between the host state and the investor. And also, emphasizing the fact that Africa's time really has come. But if I'm correct in that, then the developed world needs to recognize that in a meaningful fashion, which I don't think it's done up until now. It can't sort of treat Africa as sort of errant stepchild.
Different jurisdictions obviously have adopted different approaches to securing critical minerals for their future development. Most African countries, despite their mineral deposits, have not published policies or laws to secure their positions. What do you think African countries' approach should be to obviously ensure that they have a voice in these discussions?
Well, I think, you know, the point I made a moment ago about involving African governments more effectively by getting them to join the Mineral Security Partnership would be a first step. I mean, I think it is a bit regrettable. There's been some very early work done on critical minerals policies by African mineral producers, but frankly, it hasn't seen the light of day properly. That needs to happen. And I think that African governments need the necessary technical assistance to do that. Obviously, a lot of work's been done in the EU and obviously in the US around this, because the US has recognized this as a major issue geopolitically in terms of China, in terms of ensuring security of supply of critical minerals, but also for the defense industry in the US. Whereas I think African mining jurisdictions have been a bit behind the curve on that. But I think things should start happening this year. And as I say, some early work's been done. This is fairly undeveloped at this stage, and obviously a lot more work needs to be done on it. The question, of course, is whether how that will happen. Is that done through the African Union? The African Union, about 2009, developed a document called the African Mining Vision, which is it's sort of a template for mining in Africa and places a huge emphasis on beneficiation and industrialization, and actually encourages African mineral producers to come up with country mining visions around their mining activities, which some African countries have done. But and so that is a sort of policy for the whole of the African Union. I don't know whether the critical minerals policy work will be done centrally, or whether it's going to be done on a country by country basis, or even on a regional basis. We have to see what happens.
How important is Africa's critical minerals in terms of geopolitical context? And I suppose if you compare that to maybe other jurisdictions or continents around the world.
Oh, it's hugely important, because it Africa is a key player, and that's exactly why you have the European Union and the US reaching out to African mineral producers, getting them to sign these agreements, getting them to be part of the equation. Basically, you can't really operate in the critical mineral space without involving Africa. I mean, I think Africa is, I mean, the Latin America is obviously hugely important from a copper perspective. But, you know, the grades in Chile are declining, whereas the grades in the DRC and Zambia are generally higher. But obviously the other issues there. But I don't see how you can do anything in the critical mineral space without involving African mineral producers.
Obviously, you've mentioned the Middle East as obviously emerging player. I just wondered if you can give us some more information, and obviously from your own perspective, why the Middle East is emerging and developing as a region in this space.
Well, it's all fairly new. Obviously, you have the situation with Saudi Arabia developing its up-to-date, modern, international best practice mining law, and Saudi setting itself up as a very important processing hub for minerals from what they call the super region, which is not just Africa, but also Asia. And I think that could work well, because if you think about it, Saudi Arabia has extremely good infrastructure compared with many countries in Africa. It also has very low energy costs. There are obviously issues in relation to water, but there's also desalination on a pretty massive scale there. So that's the one point I would make about Saudi. The other thing is, you know, given the heft that the kingdom has in terms of its economy, it has the ability to attract mineral processing to the region. And at the same time, the government's done two things. One is that Marden, which is owned by the Sovereign Wealth Fund, the public investment fund, but it's also a listed company, is very active in the kingdom in terms of gold and copper and phosphates, and has joint ventures with some major mining companies globally, including Barrick in the gold mining space, gold and copper space. But in addition to that, you've now got Manara Resources, which is also a product of the public investment fund, which is going around the world. And last year, they bought a stake in Vale Base Metals in Canada, going around the world acquiring minority stakes in major mineral producers. And the idea behind that is to give them equity stake in these companies, but ensure that the process of those minerals takes place in the kingdom. So I think the kingdom's approach is both to massively develop its mining industry. So the government's embarked on a very extensive airborne geological survey, which is about half done now, of what there is, because the country has been traditionally been very underexplored. And secondly, encouraging and incentivizing exploration of the kingdom through two mechanisms. One is auctioning some exploration licenses, which they've done a number of. But secondly, and they announced this at the Future Minerals Forum, which I was at in Riyadh in January, actually providing incentives, financial incentives for exploration of the kingdom, which are very, very attractive. And that's recently been launched. So, I think both as a mineral producer and also as a processor, I think the kingdom is going to be very well placed in the future to do this. And obviously, in addition to that, Saudi Arabia sits on some pretty impressive minerals, and the government estimates its resources. Obviously, this needs to be verified in terms of reserves, but it estimates its resources being in the region of $2.5 trillion, which is a very significant figure.
And lastly, what do executives need to know in what you do within the mining industry if they're obviously facing particular challenges where they could actually use your service?
Well, I think the thing, given my experience in developing countries and also, frankly, with crisis management around that, I think the ability to think out the box is extremely important. You're not going to find the answer to many of the issues I deal with pretty much on a daily basis in a mining textbook or in a piece of legislation. I think the ability to think creatively, to think laterally, to think around the corner is really important. And having an understanding of geopolitics, I think in the work I do and we do is absolutely critical. If you don't have that and have a sort of multi-factor approach to issues, you're not going to be able to answer clients' questions, queries, and the rest of it. So one of the things I've done in some of the work I've done is working closely with the World Bank around issues around complex resource extraction issues in Africa, and international agencies and governments. That's also important. So, we've obviously developed quite a lot of work in the advocacy space, which is not something many law firms do. Some do, but I think we do it particularly well.
Peter, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for obviously sharing your knowledge around obviously mineral law and some of the changes that you've seen happen, especially in Africa. So if our audience wants to follow your story, follow any of your work, how can they go about doing that? Do you advertise yourself on social media at all?
Yeah, I am on Twitter, not that often, but I am also I'm also on LinkedIn, so they can certainly follow me on LinkedIn as well, but on Twitter as well. But I do try and post things on LinkedIn which are of interest to the mining community, and so they're welcome to do so or to approach me directly.
Yes, certainly. And we'll include those all in the show notes accompanying this episode anyway. So really thank you for your time. And just a reminder, Peter's going to be speaking at the upcoming London Indaba, which I'll include all those details in the show notes, which is happening on the 25th and 26th of June. And obviously, Peter's going to be speaking with a number of other renowned speakers in our industry around Africa's critical minerals. So again, thank you for your time. Hope you enjoyed listening to that episode. Please, as always, appreciate your continued support. Please keep sharing this these episodes far and wide, educating our mining industry and people within our mining industry around various topics that they may not come across in their daily work. So as always, thank you for listening. And until next time, happy mining.
Thank you for listening. Remember to reach out to Rob via the show notes and be sure to subscribe and leave a review. Until next time, happy mining, helping each other to improve the mining industry.